Hi, this is Dr. Adrian Lopresti. Join us on FX Medicine by Bioceuticals next week. We'll be talking to Dr. Melanie Smith on cognitive behavior therapy for menopause, hot flushes, and night sweats. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app and follow us on social media to make sure you never miss an episode.
Welcome to FX Medicine, bringing you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. I'm Dr. Michelle Waldhouse. FX Medicine acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia, where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders, past and present, and extend this respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. Coenzyme Q10 is a substance made inside our cells. It is a powerful antioxidant that helps us convert food into energy. It helps to protect your brain, your liver, and your heart, and is often touted as a great all-rounder. Is it really that good? What's the evidence surrounding its use? And should we all be taking it, and why? These questions and more will inform this next podcast with my esteemed guest. He's recognised as one of Australia's leading preventative health experts. He's a practising cardiologist with over 45 years of experience and is a keynote speaker, author of 7 best-selling books and a regular health presenter in Australian media, including a regular show on Sydney's 2GB. And he loves ubiquinol. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Dr. Ross Walker.
Thank you very much, Michelle. It's an absolute pleasure to talk with you.
So, Ross, I know you're a big fan of CoQ10. I just want to start with, like, how does it work and why do you love it?
Okay, well, I think CoQ10, and in particular ubiquinol, which is the active version of CoQ10, is a vital component of energy production. It's also a pretty damn good antioxidant. It's a fat-soluble antioxidant. But I focus more on its ability to produce good energy. And so I make the analogy here. It doesn't matter what sort of car you drive. If there's no energy in the car, it doesn't move. Mm. And it's exactly the same thing with the cells in our body. So we have this thing that every health professional knows about, the mitochondria, which are basically the little fuel packs in the cell. Now, those mitochondria are almost like turbines that are turning, belting out this stuff called ATP, which is the basic unit of energy in the cell. Now, ubiquinol is very much involved in many of these turbine functions to be able to produce high-quality ATP. So if you don't have enough ubiquinol working on these turbines, the turbines just don't move and you don't make good ATP. And the problem is that in our diet, we just don't get enough ubiquinol in the food that we eat. If you're an Eskimo and you ate a lot of organ meat, well sure, you'd probably get a reasonable amount of ubiquinol, but you've got to have something like three kilos a day of red meat to get about 100 milligrams of ubiquinol. So I do think it's important, especially when you get to a certain age, to supplement. Because the interesting thing I find, Michelle, is that when people hit around 50 years old, their energy starts to drop off. So even if they don't have a disease making them tired, there's problems with energy.
Wow, that's so, you know, I've just hit 50, so haven't dropped energy yet,
well,
but we'll wait and see.
Beyond that.
I'm following behind. So, Ross, what's the difference between ubiquinol versus ubiquinone?
Okay, ubiquinone is inactive CoQ10. So basically it has to be metabolized to work to ubiquinol. And here's the problem, and I'm going to be depressing. This is going to be depressing for most people listening to this. 30 is the peak of our life and it's all downhill from there. And when you hit 50 and the hormones go south, which they do in men and women, everything changes. And there's an enzyme called diaphorase that converts you from ubiquinone to ubiquinol. And that diaphorase enzyme just drops off when you get to 50. So you're just not making enough active ubiquinol to keep those mitochondria working. So that's the thing. Ubiquinone's there. And if you're 20, it probably really doesn't matter that much. You'll convert it to ubiquinol pretty easily because you've got a lot of diaphorase. But once you get to 30, it drops off. When you get to 50, it really, really decreases.
Wow. Right. So we make it inside our cells, but if we don't, then we can get it from organ meats or red meat. But obviously, people are not really eating as much You couldn't
eat that amount. I mean, if you ate that amount, there'd be too many other consequences of having too much. Mm. Look, I think as far as diet goes, it's what the Buddhists call the middle path, everything in moderation. And what really concerns me is not what you shouldn't be eating, but what you should be eating, which most people don't eat, which is the 2 to 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings, serving being about a half a carrot, of vegetables per day. And less than 10% of people do that. And those who do have the lowest rates of heart disease and cancer in the community. But again, to get the amount of ubiquinol you need from fruits and vegetables, you've got to have a huge amount, something like, I think it's something like 3 kilos a day of broccoli. Now, who's going to eat that? It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, well, exactly. And also, like, then we've got weight issues. Like, we're getting other issues. Like, we might be looking for one micronutrient. So supplementation seems to be kind of the way to go. So, Ross, what are you looking for when you're thinking about who can benefit from CoQ10 supplementation?
Okay, well, I've got specific indications for why I give people ubiquinol. So if someone says to me, look, I'm a high-level sportsman, well, they're chewing up their ubiquinol without activity. The muscles are really using up the energy. So I suggest to people who are sportsmen to do it, people who are feeling stressed, which is mainly basically everybody.
Mainly everyone.
So people are feeling stressed to do it. People who want more energy, which is, again, basically everyone.
So I
suggest you take at least 100, and the dose I take is 150 milligrams a day. But then as we get older and we get the more disease burden, because, see, here's the problem.
Yeah.
We're only designed physiologically to work well for 30, 40 years wandering around a jungle with a spear. Mm. And now because of modern living, we're living double AUs by date. And so because of that, when the hormones go south in your 50s, you then get all the degenerative diseases because things are wearing out. So you build up more fat in your arteries and keeps me in a job with atherosclerosis, of course.
Mm.
Then your cells change, more chance of getting cancer. But then there's things like Alzheimer's and osteoporosis and diabetes and all these things happen. You mentioned weight gain before. And the true pandemic of the 21st century is not coronavirus, it is diabetes.
Oh,
and so the problem is now we're seeing in Australia, for example, 70% of people are either obese or overweight. About 35% of people are obese, which means their BMI is greater than 30. Mm. So because of all of these things, we're getting diseases as we get over 50. And so all people with heart disease, I put them on 150 milligrams of CoQ10. If they have heart failure, they need even more because they have much more energy demands. I put them on 300 milligrams of ubiquinol. So, and the other thing, the big thing here is that unfortunately, and I think this is a bit of a tragedy, but the biggest selling drug around the planet are statins, and statins directly deplete coenzyme Q10 by affecting what's called complex 3 in the mitochondrial energy production.
Right.
And so, therefore, I give all my patients on statins ubiquinol, hopefully to counteract that effect. And I like them to take the ubiquinol with a magnesium orotate aspartate combination because it's not the magnesium, which is still very good for you for other reasons, but the orotate and the aspartate help maintain good CoQ10 production.
Mm. And the orotate too, I remember listening to a talk from you years ago, but it was like the orotic acid is actually a vasodilator as well. So it's got multiple uses,
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And so you get quite a few bangs for your buck when you have a magnesium preparation that has orotate and aspartate in it because of all of the side benefits.
Mm. I was reading actually in preparation for this the role of CoQ10 or ubiquinol in skin aging, which is also, you know, such a problem issue, particularly in countries such as ours, you know, with this hot sun and paler skin and not really adapted to this kind of climate. So how does it work in skin? Is it simply through the mitochondrial
I think it's that ATP, and it's also function, the antioxidants. You're getting the fat-soluble antioxidant benefits as well because, as we know, and I say to people, what is the biggest organ in the body? And they'll go, oh, the skin. If you're playing Trivial Pursuit, that's the right answer, but it's actually the wrong
exactly.
answer. The biggest organ in the body is the endothelium, the single layer of cells that lines every blood vessel. So a lot of the evidence is now showing that if you get evidence of skin aging and with things like wrinkles and spots and everything else that people get as they get older, that also can accelerate the aging process inside the body. So it's really important to maintain healthy skin. It is important to adopt the slip, slop, slap message and keep out of the sun as much as you can. But then the other problem, this has got nothing to do with ubiquinol, but the other problem then is you don't get enough vitamin D. Yeah. And interestingly, vitamin D is also related to high-quality skin health, but high-quality body health. People who have low vitamin D levels, that's a third of Australians, there's a link between that and osteoporosis, heart disease, cancer, multiple sclerosis, type 2 diabetes, depression, asthma, need I go on. So to me, it's I think everyone should be taking at least 2,000 units of vitamin D every day, or spending time in the sun in the non-burning times, because you just don't want to damage the skin. So ubiquinol works by keeping the mitochondria healthy in the skin, but also working as a good antioxidant to stop the antioxidant damage from things like UV light.
And what about testing, Ross? You know, do you actually test for coenzyme Q levels in the blood? Is that important?
No, look, you can do that, but I just think doctors also over-test a whole lot of things. Yeah. For example, I personally believe insulin levels, I see many of my colleagues doing this, completely useless. Why is it a useless test? Because if people are insulin resistant, as they start to get pre-diabetes, diabetes, up goes their sugar level and down goes their insulin level. So you look at their insulin level and say, oh, well, your insulin levels are fine, you're not insulin resistant. Complete nonsense. And it's a bit like this glucose tolerance test that some GPs are still ordering. It's 2 hours of your life you'll never get back. It's a complete waste of time. All you need to know is what is somebody's overnight fasting sugar level, what's their overnight fasting HbA1c, and what is the waist measurement in centimetres around their belly. And that will tell you whether they're insulin resistant or not, and whether they've got hypertension, whether their triglycerides are up, their HDL's low. Why we do a glucose tolerance test, it doesn't give you any extra information. If your HbA1c is between 5.5 to 6.5, you are pre-diabetic. If it's above 6.5, you are diabetic. Sugar level, 6 to 7.5, pre-diabetic. Above 7.5, diabetic. That's all you need to know, and a tape measure.
The tape measure is very important. I think you get a lot of information from that tape measure.
The other interesting thing with that is what I call relative fat mass, which is probably a better indication than BMI, because people who are, for example, professional athletes have a huge muscle mass. They've got a very high BMI. They'd be in the obese range, and it's ridiculous. So relative fat mass is a better measure, and that's 64 minus, in brackets, 20 times your height over your waist circumference for a male, and for a female you add 12. And if your relative fat mass is above 35% for a female, you're overweight or you're obese. Above 25% for a male, you're overweight or you're obese. And that's what you need to work on.
Well, we might write that down in the show notes to make sure people can start to use that that equation. So how important is high-sensitive CRP as a marker? Like, how do you use that in your clinic in terms of inflammation, and does that influence, you know, your decision in terms of...
I think the problem with hsCRP is it's too HS. It's too highly sensitive. and so if you've got a bit of a cold, like I'm just on the tail end of a cold at the moment, and if I did my CRP, it might be 4 or 5 because I'm on the tail end of a cold. I've seen people in the middle of COVID had CRPs of 350. And people with pneumonia, 200, people with leukemia, 100. So the only way you can interpret CRP is looking at over time. It's a bit like PSA. You don't just look at one measurement. And if over time, when people are feeling perfectly healthy without any infective or inflammatory processes going on, I like it less than 1.5. So if it's very low, it's a good positive thing to say to people, you've got a healthy immune system. But if there's any other concomitant illnesses, then you really can't interpret it that well. But I still use it, again, for things like people come with headaches, you want to know what their ESR, hsCRP is, some sort of possible inflammatory condition, you want to know what's going on there. It's like any test. There is no test in medicine that gives you all the answers.
No,
it's just a pointer. So again, if I've got someone with coronary disease, who's got a CRP and they're overweight, CRP of, say, 4 or 5, I know we can do a lot of work on their immune system to make them better. But if someone's thin, they're doing all the right things, their CRP is 0.4, I say, oh, congratulations, things are working well, whatever program you're on seems to be working.
Yeah, great. So I was reading as I was researching this about coenzyme Q10 and all-cause mortality. So a decrease in all-cause mortality, which is seriously impressive. You know, we talk about decreasing all-cause mortality by things like exercise, which is, you know, is exciting. And then they also talk about this addition of selenium having an additional impact.
Yep.
Can you talk to us about that study?
Yeah, there was a study that they actually only gave people the active treatment for 4 years. So people over the age of 70, I'm not sure exactly how many people. There's quite a few thousand, though, I think, from memory. I'm not entirely sure. I can't remember that one. But I know it was a four-year treatment study where they were given 200 milligrams of CoQ10, and it was just standard CoQ10. It wasn't ubiquinol, and 200 micrograms of selenium over 4 years. Then they followed them for 10 years. And there was something like a 50% reduction in mortality in the people
That's
who
incredible.
Were given four years of CoQ10 and selenium. But see, this is what I find bizarre, Michelle, why many of our conservative colleagues say all you get with supplements is expensive urine.
I know, you might get expensive urine, but
you also get expensive blood. So what you don't need, you urinate out.
Of course. I know, but that's just such a silly thing because it's got to go through the blood and then through the cellular makeup to make urine. That's just a crazy, crazy
It's just a silly argument. Also, you see people say, if you have an adequate diet, you don't need to supplement. Well, that's not true either. What an adequate diet does is stop you getting the deficiency diseases. But again, if you lived as a hunter-gatherer, so wandered around a jungle for 30, 40 years with a spear, all you would need is to eat the natural foods off the trees and kill an animal occasionally and eat from that. And you'd only live till you were 30 or 40 anyhow. But we're living double our use-by date in a completely synthetic world where we're being flogged with all these dreadful synthetic chemicals and radiation and chronic stresses, nothing like we were physiologically designed to. So I believe we also need extra supplementation there, of which I think ubiquinol is one of the best supplements in the market. But there are many other things that should be probably the topic of another podcast, which is, for example, the MTHFR gene, which affects 50% of people. And again, most of our colleagues don't even know a thing about it and how it works. So and that's another vital cog in this supplement mechanism that we need to talk about for modern living.
Yeah, that's right. But I wanted to move on to, you know, cognitive science. I mean, I was saying to a colleague the other day in a talk I was doing, he's like, when I was in medical school, and I'm sure before you were in medical school before me, we never even had the term brain fog. Like that's only really been around for about 10 years, I think. Yep. So tell us about what CoQ10 does in terms of cognition and what brain aging science is telling us, and how's that linked to cardiovascular disease, for example?
Well, firstly, this is a bit of a left field thing, but I think we've got to go back to the gut when we talk about brain fog and we talk about CoQ10 and everything else, because I believe almost everyone living in the modern world has a degree of gut dysbiosis, and I also believe about 10% of people were born with defective mitochondria. So there are full-blown mitochondrial diseases or the mitochondrial myopathies, which are really rare. But 10% of people, their mitochondria just don't work that well. So they're the people that hated the cross countries at school, didn't like sport, weren't attracted to it, and then they get into their 20s and 30s and get something like Epstein-Barr and it pushes them into chronic fatigue syndrome. But I still believe that the gut dysbiosis is a big part of this as well. So with the recent, I'm getting back to you, I haven't forgotten your brain fog question, but we can bring in the COVID pandemic and people getting long COVID and the symptoms of long COVID, brain fog, fatigue, shortness of breath and a whole lot of other ancillary symptoms as well. But they're the three key symptoms of long COVID. Interestingly, exactly the same symptoms as chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, brain fog, fatigue, shortness of breath. And I believe what happens is that the COVID virus, the coronavirus, pulverized the gut bacteria, and all of these pathogenic bacteria grew in, which didn't make good quality energy, didn't make good quality serotonin, didn't make good quality short-chain fatty acids, butyrate, pyruvate, acetate. And so these people were getting almost a severe acute leaky gut syndrome where they weren't getting the right chemicals going into their bloodstream, and it just causes incredible brain fog. And again, the mitochondria. We have thousands of mitochondria in cells in the heart, in the brain, and if your mitochondria in the brain aren't working well, your brain's not working well. So I give everyone with long COVID, chronic fatigue, anyone who's got symptoms of brain fog or whatever, I give them at least 300 milligrams of ubiquinol for a few months until they start to feel better. Then I'll pull it back to a maintenance dose of 150 milligrams with the magnesium orotate aspartate combinations as well.
Yeah, nice.
And also a high quality probiotic, and also I give them other things like anti-inflammatories like curcumin. Curcumin boswellia is a really good anti-inflammatory supplement you can give people as well to improve their immune system.
So I just wanted to get your thoughts on oxidative stress. You know, so I mean, a lot of people still don't even kind of consider oxidative stress a stressor. Why do we get more of it when we age, and what do you think the biggest source of oxidative stress is apart from biological aging?
Well, I think firstly that you've then got to, I mean, there's another podcast here just talking about anti-aging. and one of the big components of anti-aging is the generation of these senescent cells. And senescent cells, I make an analogy here, like a whole lot of people going on a walk, but there are people in their 20s, people in their 80s going on the walk. Well, it's obvious, and I'm not being ageist here, but it's obvious that the people in their 80s are going to hold up the people in their 20s because they can't keep up. And it's the same thing with the senescent cells. They're basically draining the energy of the younger people and slowing them down and also releasing these pro-inflammatory cytokines. And basically the whole free radical antioxidant hypothesis is pretty straightforward. Every time there's any chemical reaction in your body, there's a waste product produced, and that waste product has to be eliminated. So the waste product are mopped up by the antioxidant system. But if you're making too many free radicals just by general wear and tear in life, and then you throw illnesses on top of that, stresses on top of that, all the horrible synthetic chemicals we're being exposed to all the day. We're hearing almost every day things about these forever chemicals. We hear about BPA and this con job. We're BPA free bottles. No, that's because they've got BPS, bisphenol S, which is just as bad for you. So what I'm saying is all of these chemicals that we're being exposed to have to be mopped up by our antioxidant system, and often that gets overwhelmed by these excessive chemicals, excessive illnesses as we get older, excessive senescent cells. All of these, it's all of the above, Michelle, is overwhelming this system. And that's why we do need extra antioxidants. Let's go back to the old style vitamin E, vitamin C. In 2004, a guy called Edgar Miller did a editorial in the Annals of Internal Medicine saying that not only does vitamin E do nothing, but it also may cause harm. And when you looked at what he was talking about, he quoted 11 studies. 8 of them used synthetic vitamin E by itself. Three studies where they combined vitamin E with vitamin C, they're all synthetic. And so that's D-L-alpha-tocopherol, which doesn't work. D-alpha-tocopherol is natural vitamin E, and the tocotrienols are even better. And there's only been two studies in the history of evidence-based medicine where they combine natural vitamin E with vitamin C, because I don't think you should do them without. And both those studies showed a 25% reduction in the progression of atherosclerosis. And we don't even talk about this stuff. So that's the IVA study and the ASAP study. Both studies, 25% reduction in the progression of atherosclerosis. So they're two very highly effective antioxidants, as is ubiquinol.
Yeah, it's beautiful. What about things like glutathione and superoxide dismutase and all the precursors and conjugates associated with that? Do you like a wide variety of antioxidants?
Yeah, I think the sulfur-based antioxidants are probably pretty good. Their selenium is important in generating good glutathione metabolism. Some people are specifically talking about glutathione antioxidants. But there's a bit of a problem with all of this, Michelle. You get to the point where how much can people afford?
I know.
You walk into a health food store or a chemist and you see shelf upon shelf upon shelf of vitamins. So what I've done in my 45-year career is I've cherry-picked what I believe to be the most effective. And I think you probably get to the point where you take a certain amount of supplements and you've saturated the system anyhow. You don't need any more. People say, oh, we've got this new miracle supplement, or this thing here, that thing there, and it doesn't do much more than the other one. So I think I've got a suite of really five what I call cardiac supplements that I use in all of my patients, and then I target other particular conditions, something we haven't even spoken about, lipoprotein little A, that doctors have only shown some interest in the last 2 or 3 years because they're now developing 4 drugs around the world to pulverize lipoprotein little A. I've actually been measuring it in my patients for 30 years and have been treating it with a combination of vitamin C, vitamin E, and lysine to great effect for that time. But again, I can't give you any long-term study to back up what I'm saying. I can only give you 45 years of medical experience.
Well, that's part of the evidence base, isn't it? Clinical experience as well. So
I think it is. But again, these days you've got to have the randomized controlled clinical trial, which I think is very legitimate for drugs. Because, this is the analogy I make. Drugs are like a high-performance motor car. Get you from A to B very quickly, but with the potential of crashing and killing yourself. So you've got to have seatbelts, safety rules, safety mechanisms in the car. And therefore you do need randomized controlled trials for pharmaceutical drugs because they have strong effects, but very strong side effects and the strong potential for harm. Whereas supplements are like a bicycle. Get you from A to B much slower, but all you need to do is wear a helmet and keep away from cars and you get the extra benefit of exercise. But you don't need the same rigid evidence base. All you need to do is demonstrate, as I just did with vitamin E, vitamin C, surrogate markers to show that they're benefiting people.
And also just an understanding of the basic physiology too. I think that gets missed, you know, in modern day general practice, certainly. Like, you know, we're very much dominated by a pharmacological mindset rather than the basic physiology and functionality of the system that we're working with, really. But I wanted to, because of your expertise as a cardiologist, I really wanted to talk about statins because, as you mentioned, they are one of the highest, if not highest, used drugs across the planet.
Most prescribed drugs on the planet.
Yeah, and I've heard cardiologists say we should put it in the water supply, which I find just despicable.
Disturbing.
disturbing, exactly. Let's drill down on that. I mean, obviously, you know, every patient that I see that's on statins, I recommend them being on CoQ10.
Ubiquinol.
What evidence, what evidence do we have for that? Like I still see, you know, when we look at the research, there's still lots of controversy. Why have we got such controversy around this? Why isn't other cardiologists doing this?
I just think they haven't read the evidence properly. For example, studies show clearly, there were quite a few studies out to show that statins reduce CoQ10 levels. No doubt about that. Studies have been proven. And there's one or two studies to show that if you supplement people with, I think one study I read was only 60 milligrams of ubiquinol, which I don't think is enough. You reduce muscle pain and stiffness by about 50%, as one example. Because we know, let's look at the evidence. We know that statins affect CoQ10 level at this complex 3 in the mitochondria. It's been proven beyond a doubt. So we know they do that. We know they do it. Now, again, if you read the randomized controlled clinical trials, they will tell you that myalgia only occurs in less than 5% of people taking statins. And if you look outside your window, you'll see a pig flying across the sky. Because I can assure you that it's much more than that. But you see, the reason why they're saying this is they have a very strict definition for myalgia. It is muscle pain with a CPK level 3 times the normal range. That's the definition of myalgia. So obviously you're going to miss out a lot of people. But I can assure you 20% of people who take statins without ubiquinol, 20% of people who take statins get problems with muscle pain, stiffness, weakness, cramping, and over a long period of time, loss of muscle bulk, so they get muscle atrophy. But that's not in the strict definition of myalgia. So conservative doctors will say, oh, statins don't cause the side effects. But you see, I think this is the answer, Michelle, having, again, done this for 45 years, that I believe the public gives statins far too much pain and the medical profession gives statins far too much power. And this is really the key to this discussion, in my view. I believe everyone's management should be on what I call the 80-10-10 rule. Now, what do I mean by that? 80% of our management has nothing to do with damn doctors. We're not that powerful. 80% is how people look after themselves. It's what I call the five keys of being healthy. I'll go through it very quickly, from the least important to the most important. You cannot be healthy and have any addiction. So anyone who smokes, drinks too much grog or snorts cocaine is ill. Number two, good quality sleep. 7 to 8 hours of good quality sleep is as good for your body as not smoking. Number three is nutrition. Eat less, eat more naturally, 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day. Avoid processed packaged crap masquerading as food, and also avoid white death, which is sugar, white bread, pasta, potatoes, rice. Number four is the second best drug on the planet. You've already alluded to this. 3 to 5 hours every week of moderate exertion, and it should be 2/3 cardio, 1/3 resistance training, and just having that sort of exercise habit, even if you don't look at any other health parameter, reduces your risk by 30%, heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes, 50% reduction, depression and osteoporosis, drops your blood pressure, you sleep better. And a study of I think it was something like 20,000 men over 20 years showed that those who were high-level exercisers compared with those people who did no exercise, so the high level is what I'm talking about, the 3 to 5 hours a week, had a 58% reduction in all-cause death.
Oh,
so why, and only 25% of the population exercises. So it just does my head in. And number five, the best drug on the planet easily is a thing called happiness. Now, that is 80% of anyone's management. 10% is the appropriate use of pharmaceutical drugs if they need it, and I'll get onto the statin in a second, and 10% is the appropriate use of evidence-based supplements. Now, as far as statin goes, who needs statins? And this is very, very clear from the medical evidence, the medical literature. The only people who need statin drugs are people who've already had a heart attack, stent, bypass, or an atherosclerosis-related stroke, or people who have a coronary calcium score that puts them above the 50% average for their age group. So, for example, if you're between 50 to 70, if your coronary calcium score is below 100, you do not need a statin. And I don't care what your cholesterol level is. So I saw a woman the other day with a cholesterol of 10 and an HDL of 2 and a calcium score of 0. She's been obviously given statins and told if you don't take a statin, you're going to die from heart disease, which is scaremongering nonsense. Her calcium score is 0, and every time she takes a statin, she can't lift her arms. And I said, you don't need a statin. But every other doctor would say she does because her cholesterol is so high. But her cholesterol, in her particular case, is not spilling into her arteries. So if I can demonstrate someone has significant atherosclerosis, which is what the calcium score tells you, and Michelle, again, a plea to everyone listening, CT coronary angiography is not a screening test for heart disease. It should not be done in asymptomatic patients. There's been a head-to-head comparison in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology for the predictive value of calcium scoring over CT angiography. Calcium scoring wins hands down, and you'll get this nonsense argument from some cardiologists, oh, but I've seen people with a zero calcium score with a high-level block in their arteries. Yes, that rarely occurs, about 1 in 500 people. But it doesn't justify the 499 people that you're charging $1,000 to because there is no Medicare rebate if you're asymptomatic, that you're giving an intravenous injection to, they can have an anaphylactic reaction or it can damage their kidneys, that you're irradiating them with more radiation than a standard calcium score, and you're making their wallet $500 to $600 lighter.
So just on statins, the other drug that I thought, like, you know, I was looking at, you know, drug interactions and ubiquinol, and the other one that came up, which has been exploding in the last kind of 10, 15 years, is the role of bisphosphonates and that having a negative impact on the endothelial lining, increasing oxidative stress and showing that ubiquinol can help protect against that negative impact of such an important drug as well.
Yeah, well, you see, I don't use bisphosphonates at all for all the reasons that you're saying, for all the long-term side effects. And I really don't think the evidence that it helps the bones is that compelling. The only one that I use is the Prolia, the denosumab. I can't send these silly monoclonal antibody names, but the denosumab Prolia, which I think, again, it's not without its side effects, but it's nowhere near that of bisphosphonate. So I just wouldn't use bisphosphonates anymore. I just don't think there's any compelling evidence that we have a better drug. So when you have a better drug, why use the older drugs that have the jaw necrosis and everything else that goes with it? And it's a bit like with statins. I don't use the fat-soluble statins, atorvastatin or simvastatin. I only use rosuvastatin or pravastatin because in my experience, in the long term, because, again, people go in their 50s and they're given a statin because their cholesterol's high. Now, a person could live for another 50 years. Who can tell them the drug's safe over a 50-year period? But what I'm saying is, having seen people on these drugs 20, 30, 40 years, you see that the people on the fat-soluble statins get many more long-term side effects than the water-soluble statins. So I think for all pharmaceuticals, don't think about the short game. Think about the long game. What potentially could this be doing to people in the long term?
And what about LDL oxidization and LDL subfractions? Do you like
this really does my head in, because you see that still there's this ignorance, and I've even heard plenty of high-level cardiologists say this: LDL is bad, HDL is good. That is simplistic nonsense. LDL and HDL are divided into small bits and large bits, and here's where size is important. The larger your LDL, the larger your HDL, the better it is for you. And so, for example, I'll give you a great example. A 55-year-old woman goes, I'm just using a female example here, goes into a doctor with a cholesterol, total cholesterol 7.5, triglycerides of 0.7, HDL of 2.5, and the doctor says, oh, you've got a very high cholesterol, you must be on a statin. Doesn't even bother doing a calcium score. They typically have zero calcium scores. These people are called lean hyperresponders, and it is good. It is healthy to be like that. They should be congratulated and left alone, because these people just have all large LDL, large HDL. Now you say, well, why don't we just measure it in everybody? Because it's expensive. It costs people $250. What I do, I get the calcium score, which is a better long-term predictor anyhow. If the calcium score is zero and they've got that cholesterol profile, I know it's all large. I leave them as it is. So we shouldn't be lowering. I don't treat cholesterol at all. I treat risk. If somebody's at high risk, yes, I will use a statin as a small part of their management. And if they get side effects from the statin, I go, look, you're statin intolerant. You can't take it. You're missing out on 10% of your management. So what? But somebody comes in with a big fat gut or a fag hand in their mouth and they go, oh, doctor, I need my Lipitor. I go, what's going on in your skull? You know, you're sitting there looking like this with the cigarette in your mouth, and you think that Lipitor is going to be your salvation. So this is what disturbs me, Michelle, that people think that the key to good health is lowering a number in your bloodstream with a pill. I mean, really? And it's absolute nonsense. And so therefore, as far as the subfractions go, the only time I'd ever measure subfractions in people are people that have unexplained coronary artery disease. 70% of coronary disease is due to insulin resistance or related to insulin resistance. And that's so easy to pick up. You don't need flash tests. You just need the overnight fasting sugar and HbA1c, a blood pressure measurement, the triglyceride, HDL, look at that, the tape measure around the belly. You can pick up that they're insulin resistance. That's 70% of heart disease. 20% is due to Lpa, lipoprotein little a. So 90% of heart disease is explained by two simple genes. Then there's the oft-quoted familial hypercholesterolemia, and that's one in 250 people. It's not that common. Everyone carries on about it as it's the benchmark to talk about coronary artery disease. It's a small proportion of coronary artery disease, and there's a whole lot of other genetic issues. But all heart disease is genetic. But your genes loads the gun, then your environment pulls the trigger.
Oh, and, you know, speaking about, you know, those five pillars of health, exercise and food and stress management and
happiness.
Sleep and happiness and all of those kind of things is really the elixir that – I think, you know, medicine seems to be, you know, almost, it's a bit of a strong word, but, you know, like addicted to this sort of technological kind of intervention. And when we're talking technological stuff and not talking about the basics, it seems so kind of futile.
Well, but again, can I just make the point that we're now sort of moving into the era of genetic screening and all that sort of business? But in the end, the advice is still the same. It's still the five keys of being healthy. And when you look at the areas around the world, those blue zones, the five blue zones around the world, Okinawa, Ikaria in Greece, Sardinia in Italy, the Nicoya province of Costa Rica, and the Seventh-day Adventists living in Loma Linda in California, they've never heard of Lipitor or GYMS or genetic testing, and they have enormous longevity because they're basically practicing the five keys of being healthy. That's it. And if people got that and they just realised, look, make your life simpler, have a regular exercise habit, love your partner, eat good quality food, have good quality sleep, and don't be addicted to anything. I mean, it's not rocket science, but it's the most important message of this. Look, I'm a great believer in ubiquinol. I'm a great believer in a number of other supplements, but it's only 10% of people's management. And don't ever think. I'll tell you a disturbing story. I got a woman who came in to see me, and she, and I'm not known for my subtlety, Michelle, but she came in to see me, and she didn't like conventional medicine. So she was treating her endometrial cancer with apricot kernels. She refused to take her antihypertensive therapy, despite the fact that her blood pressure was far too high. She plonked 20 supplements on my table. She said, but doctor, I'm taking all these supplements, as if I was going to congratulate her. And I said to her, let's talk about the elephant in the room, you, because she was morbidly obese. And she was doing nothing about that. And she thought the supplements were going to be her, and the apricot kernels were going to be her salvation. It was just complete and utter nonsense. So as I say on the speaking circuit quite often when I give talks, people are climbing the ladder to success to find they're on the wrong wall. We've got to get back on the right wall. And the right wall is focusing mainly on lifestyle and realizing that lifestyle is four times more powerful than drugs or supplements.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you speak my language. Oh, my goodness. What a masterclass, Dr. Ross Walker. Thank you so much for sharing all these incredibly helpful and practical insights, particularly around, you know, some of those practical day-to-day things that we see all the time. You know, I know this episode is one that will be listened to time and time again. So thank you so much.
Michelle, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts, and other resources mentioned from today's episode on the FX Medicine website. I'm Dr. Michelle Woolhouse. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Enjoyed this episode? Subscribe to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals on YouTube by pressing our logo. You can also head to bioceuticals.com.au/education for more healthcare professional resources.